Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
It is such an honor to be here at Washington and Lee, nestled as it is in my home state and the greatest state in the Union, Virginia. And before I begin, I have a number of people who justly deserve thanks. Thank you to Emma Jones at the Thomistic Institute for all of her valiant and unsung work behind the scenes. Thank you to my mother and to my girlfriend, both of whom listened to early versions of this talk with heroic patience, careful attention, and an unflinching willingness to provide lots of feedback. Lots of feedback. To make these arguments better. Thank you especially to all of you for being here, and in a particular way, I want to single out for thanks those in the audience who are preparing to serve our country and its armed forces, and to undertake the often thankless task of preserving freedom at home and abroad. But I want to save my most significant gratitude for one group of people in particular, the leadership team of the Washington and Lee Virginia Military Institute chapter of the Thomistic Institute, and especially to Professor Taylor, Mr. Dominic Vogelbacher, Ms. Ramsey Green, and the excellently named John Paul Adams. Mr. Adams and his team in inviting me here are fulfilling a lifelong dream of mine to be able to come and be a part of this community, just as my grandfather Carl did. John Carl Mary Heil was a member of the VMI class of 1968 and served with distinction in both Vietnam and Operation Desert Shield before passing away 2 years ago from a sudden pulmonary embolism. Though he always denied it, Grandpa was a hero in my family, a man of quiet dignity and gravitas who always attributed his strength of character to the formation he had received at the VMI. Though he wanted me to follow in his footsteps in joining the service, I discerned a different path, a path which, through the grace of God, working through the kindness of the Thomistic Institute's team here, has led me back here after all. So if you could please join me in thanking these students for their tireless work and for the gift that they've given me. So let's So how would you all react if I told you that everything I just said was a complete and total fabrication? What I just did was something called simulatio. Simulatio is a rhetorical technique from the ancient world. It involves dropping your clip on the ground. And it's one of the easiest ways a speaker can manipulate his audience into liking him. When a speaker knows he's going to be speaking in front of a large group of people who either don't know who he is or who might be wary of him, maybe because he hasn't clearly declared how he feels about the Austrian School of Economics, it's really important that he gets his audience over to his side as quickly as possible. So what's he supposed to do? Well, one of the things that he can do is exaggerate and play things up, and especially emphasize how humble he is. When Cicero, arguably the greatest thinker in the ancient world when it comes to how to speak well, writes about simulatio, he recommends that speechmakers not only play up how grateful they are to the politically important and popular people, like, say, the people organizing the event who must play some sort of central role in the community, but also to get the audience to empathize with you as quickly as possible. What Cicero doesn't argue for, but later readers of him in the Renaissance and early modern period will, is that it's really important to get your audience to connect with you emotionally as soon as you can. And if you have to bend the truth somewhat to make that happen, to get your audience to trust you, then so be it, as long as the message you're conveying or the image you're projecting is for the sake of the common good. The health of the state, the health of the community, provides every member of the body politic with the moral justification to be able to deceive and mislead, so long as the common good remains your final aim. So if I wanted you to listen to what I had to say, and I believed that the content of my argument would build up and protect the civic life we share, the res publica, then it would be completely morally justifiable for me to say, invent a tragic story about a heroic grandfather, when my actual grandfather, an Air Force veteran, is not only alive and well, but to my knowledge, has never once set foot on the VMI campus. And his name's not even Carl. Now, the reason I bring up simulatio and its development in Renaissance political thought is not because it aligns with the thought of St. Thomas Aquinas, quite the opposite, but because simulatio is at the root of modern marketing. If you're just here because you want a quick and dirty answer to the question posed in the title, "Does marketing make us less human?" my answer, spoiler alert, is going to be yes. If by marketing we're referring to the currently accepted definition proposed by the American Marketing Association, which in turn determines, in part, how marketing textbooks used in business classrooms define marketing. The AMA contends that marketing is the activity, set of institutions, and processes for creating, communicating, delivering, and exchanging offerings that have value for customers, clients, partners, and society at large. The document that governs how marketers should put this definition into practice is the AMA's Statement of Ethics, which claims that the first principle for marketers is to do no harm, which means not only consciously avoiding harmful actions or omissions, but also striving to benefit all stakeholders in society at large. Its second principle is to foster and maintain integrity, which means striving for transparency and fairness in all aspects of the marketing ecosystem. Its third principle is to embrace the ethical values emerging from these first two principles that the AMA argues that society as a whole finds important: honesty, responsibility, equity, transparency, and citizenship. The AMA's branch in Boston further provides suggestions for how to implement these principles by embracing the human element of marketing, which includes, first, empathizing with our customers to build a marketing experience around the customer, ensuring that you're offering them what you might want in your place. Second, to humanize our brand so that customers can interact with a brand they might think of like a friend. And third, of course, to connect with customers via social media so we can solicit ongoing feedback on the value we're offering them. Throughout all of these ethical statements, so concerned with the human element of our marketing, the AMA provides no explicit definition of what a human being actually is. It articulates no clear anthropology, no account of what it means to be human. But though it doesn't state unambiguously how it understands what a human being is, the AMA still argues for an implicit anthropology, which we can discern through careful attention to its statements about the so-called ethical values of marketing and AMA's Boston's suggestion for implementation. That implicit anthropology is one rooted in deception, in simulated exaggeration and dissimulated irony, that fails to recognize the dignity of human beings as rational animals, that is, as made for the truth and for reality. The organization responsible for defining what marketing is commits an affront to the value of human life in attempting to cover the practice of marketing in a language of ethics and values and fairness and equity, and in so doing, instrumentalizes human life and human language for the sake of an ulterior motive, locking marketers and customers both into a vision of the cosmos in which the world's value is entirely determined by abundant quantity rather than the good of its formed nature. Any type of truly honest, truly transparent, and truly ethical marketing must be based on a more adequate anthropology. Now, whenever I'm listening to a lecture, I like to know what the plan is, so that way I can at least plan out my bathroom breaks. So here's where we're going. We're going to explore a few more key definitions related to the AMA's contemporary vision of marketing before turning to why the implicit anthropology it operates on is insufficient to justify acting according to the values the organization states are at the heart of marketing. We're then going to follow the AMA's ideas about marketing as friendship to their logical conclusions. We're going to do that first by talking about how this strategy parallels anti-Thomistic Renaissance ideas about how to lie virtuously. We're then going to turn to how this anthropology implies a cosmology, a vision of the universe, and explore how marketers at PepsiCo, Unilever, and McDonald's have adopted and stripped the term regenerative agriculture of any meaning to justify a cosmology of quantity rather than form. We will then dive more deeply into the AMA's conception of marketing as empathetic, showing how marketing techniques that use irony to get the viewer onto their side weaponize empathy to turn the viewer into a marketer. We will then conclude by considering what it actually does mean to be human, drawing on the thought of the great Thomistic philosopher Joseph Pieper to see how the AMA's accounts of marketing strike at and wound the core of the human person, while also trying to discern a way forward for how to market in a more truly human way. So 8 points. Does this sound good? If you start falling asleep, I'll just start throwing things at you from up here. Okay, the AMA's definition of marketing as the activity, set of institutions, and processes for creating, communicating, delivering, and exchanging offerings that have value for customers, clients, partners, and society at large suggests that marketing's goal is to provide value and to serve the customer, which sounds pretty great. Kettler, Keller, and Chernev, who wrote one of the standard MBA textbooks on marketing management, the one that I used in my marketing management class at Mount St. Mary's, see the AMA's definition as an attempt to disprove a general societal misapprehension that marketing is the art of selling products. These scholars link the AMA's definition to the thought of Peter Drucker, father of modern management theory, who claimed that there will always, one can assume, be need for some selling. But the aim of marketing is to make selling superfluous. The aim of marketing is to know and understand the customer so well that the product or service fits him and sells itself. Ideally, marketing should result in a customer who is ready to buy. All that should be needed then is to make the product or service available. If we follow Drucker's theory, marketing begins with us understanding human beings. In order to do that, we need to figure out what it means to be a human being. But if you try to look up human or person in the glossary of a marketing textbook, your search will prove fruitless. The closest the AMA comes to defining a human being is in its discussion of marketing ethics, in which the organization claims that human beings are motivated by values, which are deeply personal, shaped by individual experience, cultural context, and organizational mission. What feels like the right course of action in one setting may not hold in another, and it is a challenge to get all stakeholders, including employees, aligned around a shared set of values. AMA Boston defines the human factor in data-driven marketing as the connections that bind our societies and foster a pleasant human experience, being approachable, empathetic, and relatable, designing solutions and messaging that directly address real-world problems, fostering inclusivity and accessibility. It's tempting in any organization to focus on values first. But in the ancient and pre-modern worlds, the two fields which dealt with the questions now underpinning contemporary marketing, philosophy and rhetoric, both agreed that ethical claims, statements about what should and should not be done, can only be made if we first come to a clear consensus about fact, definition, cause, and quality first. In more familiar terms, whenever we make an ethical claim that someone should or should not do something, we assume, whether we're aware of it or not, an anthropology, which includes an idea of what kind of world we live in, what it means to be human, whether or not we have particular purpose, and whether human life is any good or not. As my colleague Stephen McGinley has argued, ethics and values presuppose an anthropology, which in turn presupposes a cosmology. How we act reveals the way we think about human beings, and how we think about human beings reveals the way we think about the world. So brass tacks, even though our marketing textbooks or leading marketing organizations might not provide an explicit definition of what it means to be human, they still operate under an implied anthropology. And that anthropology is extremely squishy. If we try to put together an image of a human being based on what we've heard so far, what it means to be human is to be an entity with desires that we as marketers have a responsibility to address with products or services that can fit those desires. We could, if we so desired, manipulate these entities pretty easily through this process of creating, communicating, delivering, and exchanging offerings that have value for customers, which is extremely powerful in shaping the desires of a society in general. But with this great power comes great responsibility. We should ensure that this authority aligns with and is motivated by values like empathy, because marketers are also human, and we should do unto others as we would want to happen to us. We should try to resolve the problems facing humanity using the power marketing gives us by framing these interactions with our customers as if they were our friends. The rationale the AMA provides for why we should follow this golden rule of empathy, treating our customers like friends rather than manipulable cattle, is because empathy is a human value, and we should follow human values. Why? Well, per the AMA statement of ethics, all stakeholders of the community are expected to embrace the highest ethical norms implied by our responsibility to society. And why do we have this responsibility to society? According to the statement of ethics, because values represent the collective understanding of what the community finds appropriate, desirable, and morally acceptable, and therefore serve as the criteria for evaluating our own personal actions and the actions of others. The community, then, and societal consensus are the final arbiters, according to the AMA, of what makes an action right or wrong. But the problem goes deeper than the obvious issues with assuming that right and wrong are based on what's acceptable to a majority. Because what rationale do we have for listening to the community in the first place? Why does society have value? Well, it has value because human beings have value. Who decided that human beings have value? Social consensus. So you sort of see the circularity here. This is a problem with making ethical claims absent clear definitions of human action. For the leading marketing organization in the United States, which determines the standard definition of marketing that we all use and are all tested on in our MBA classes, what it means to be human is to be an entity that not only recognizes value, as per Peter Drucker's observations, but decides the value of things, up to and including the value of human life. In this view, social consensus about a particular group of values like honesty or empathy trumps your feelings about that particular value. Perhaps Dominic does not, for whatever reason, want to implement transparency into his work as a marketer, at least in the AMA, in the way the AMA defines it, as striving for a spirit of openness in all aspects of the marketing profession. On the one hand, the AMA claims that values are deeply personal, shaped by individual experience, cultural context, and organizational mission. On the other hand, it also asserts that transparency as defined as an ethical norm is defined as an ethical norm which we as marketers must affirm. Values are subjective and personal until the crowd decides that they are not, until we reach a consensus that in fact some values are more objective, more valuable than others. Taking a closer look at the AMA's encouragement that we should see marketing as empathetic and a kind of friendship reveals the absurdity of its implicit anthropology. The AMA doesn't define what friendship means, but let's presume it wants us to strive for the best type of friendship possible, based on the golden rule it previously evoked that we should do unto others as we would want done unto us. Let's also presume that the AMA wants us to strive for the best type of friendship possible, a friendship in which we build up our customers in excellence, perhaps by offering products that in some way help them to foster the same values the AMA has decided that society values. Honesty, transparency, equity, responsibility, and citizenship. In the Paradigm Treatise on Friendship from the Ancient World, De Amicitia, forgive my terrible Latin. I was just speaking with somebody ahead of time who was studying French, and anyway, forgive my accent. Cicero argues that true friendships of excellence that aim to make the other truly exceptional reject the golden rule. We don't want to treat our best friends the way that we would want to be treated. We treat them even better. We aim to do more for them than we would ever do for ourselves. What then do we do with customers who fail to see the value of our product for their lives, who cannot see how it will make them more responsible or transparent or equitable? If we want them to become better, shouldn't we play up as much as possible the quality of our products or services to get our audience to perceive their value? What's wrong with exaggerating the truth just a little bit for the sake of making our customers better, which would certainly build up the communal good? This was exactly the position that certain Renaissance humanists, who were very careful readers of ancient rhetorical techniques, took in the years leading up to Machiavelli's Prince, which inverted classical and Christian virtue ethics and placed the rightness or wrongness of an action not in a person's character or intention or the deed itself, but in the consequences of the action. Giovanni Pontano, for instance, who wrote one of the High Renaissance's leading treatises on rhetoric, broke with Cicero and scholastic writers who saw deception in speech as dangerous to the common good, unless you're deceiving for the sake of a joke. Rather, Pontano took a cue from Socrates, whom he saw as often simulating and dissimulating, simulating as exaggerating the arguments of his opponents to show their absurdity, or dissimulating in the sense of using irony to downplay the truth of his own intellect. Pontano wrote how, in politically tumultuous times like his own day, the customs which should be held by all good men have been made unbecoming. For in virtue nothing should be feigned, nothing simulated. Yet now and then, so great is the strength of fortune, calamity, inconstancy, and the vicissitudes of human things, that in some places and times it will be necessary to not only simulate, but also to dissimulate the truth into fictions, to exaggerate, simulate, or downplay, dissimulate, the truth of reality for the sake of some greater good. Pontano goes on to say that the one who practices simulation and dissimulation well will be considered honestum, most exceptionally morally excellent, and indeed worthy of highest praise. Pontano argues that all virtuous citizens, whether they be man or woman, young or old, rich or poor, noble or peasant, priest or laity, should simulate and dissimulate as long as it will make the body politic, the res publica, better. He contends that this behavior is analogous to that of a clever and industrious doctor who creates fictions to treat his patients. When a patient is in a dangerous situation, perhaps going into a dangerous operation, the doctor tells him everything is going to be okay, even though he knows it probably won't be. In cases when the doctor has to deliver a painful remedy, he will tell the patient the pain isn't going to be so bad. So too is it when we deal with the problems facing our fellow citizens. Our sweet simulations are the spoonful of sugar that helps the medicine go down. That, to use modern terms, help those around us empathize with us so we can better help them connect and engage with ideas or things that we perceive as having value for society as a whole. Pontano's logic presupposes that we do, in fact, know what is truly good for society as a whole, and that those things really will contribute to the common good if people just valued them or possessed them. It also assumes that we know what the consequences of our deception are going to be, and that we know what is better for our friends and our fellow citizens than they do. But if we're not thinking about that, or if we possess sufficient confidence in our own ability to discern what is right or wrong on the behalf of others, to be the doctors of society, then Pontano's arguments are the logical conclusion of AMA Boston's call to humanize marketing through empathy and ersatz friendship. As long as our customers, our fellow citizens, and friend substitutes have the chance to become more excellent through using our valuable offerings, shouldn't we use our great power as marketers to make sure that as many people as possible see that value, even if we must simulate or dissimulate? We believe people will truly be made better if they have the product or service we represent. So if that's the case, then if we have to exaggerate or downplay the truth of the product or our behavior, so be it. Now it's fine for me to be up here shinily proclaiming to you, postulating that marketers might simulate or dissimulate the reality of their offerings based on their belief that they know what's better for their customers than their customers do. But is this actually happening in marketing? Yes. And the way marketers are enacting the simulation and dissimulation reveals how a faulty anthropology can lead to a faulty cosmology, how getting things wrong about human beings can lead to deeply disordered ideas about what kind of world we're living in. One of the AMA's central values of ethical marketing, citizenship, requires that marketers strive to protect the ecological environment and communicate sustainability efforts and aspirations honestly and transparently. One of the ways agribusinesses have attempted to communicate how they value citizenship is through adopting the language of regenerative agriculture. Now, it's very difficult to define regenerative agriculture, so much so that certain portions of Congress are currently debating what it actually means. But its most robust articulation comes from philosopher farmers like Wendell Berry, who try to build out how human beings are responsible to the soil and the fundamental ontological, meaning connection in being, between human beings and the earth present in the Genesis accounts of creation. Regenerative agriculture is a response to how the technocratic paradigm has affected our land. For example, in my own home of Northern Frederick County, Maryland, large agribusinesses followed the USDA's production-oriented policies implemented in the 1970s and factory-farmed our fields, overplanting high-impact crops like soy and corn over and over and over again until the soil was so nutrient-drained that the only thing it could sustain was grass. To keep production going for as long as possible, these companies used chemical pesticides that soaked into the ground and killed the vital fungal networks that tell crop systems which nutrients are needed where. When yields went down because the networks died, our county's corporate farmers started using GMO versions of the food they were trying to grow, which only accelerated the soil's nutrient loss. In his essay, Quantity Versus Form, Berry identifies this behavior as a quantity mindset, which, according to him, in agricultural science, agribusiness, and the food industry, aims to increase production ad infinitum as their only aim. They will increase production by any means and at any cost, even at the cost of future productivity, for they have no functioning idea of ecological or agricultural or human limits. The ideology of quantity opposes the more ancient form of a farm as a form. A farm as a form. Say that five times fast. That's your homework for tonight. Under this way of life in Berry's ecosystem, the art of farming mimics on the farm the self-renewing processes of the local ecosystem. But that is not all. The art of farming is also the art of living on a farm. The form of a farm, is partly in its embodied consciousness of ecological obligation, and thus in its annual cycle of work. But it is also in the arrangement of fields and buildings in relation to the life of the farm's human family, whose focus is the household. There is thus a convergence, or even a coincidence, between the form of a farm and the form of a farming life. The art of sustaining fertility and the art of living on a farm are mutually enhancing and mutually reinforcing. As Stephen McGinley has argued, what Barry is describing here is essentially the meaning of the Hebrew word male. This is the word used when Yahweh calls humanity in Genesis 1 to fill the earth and subdue it. Filling and subduing in this ancient sense means something closer to our English word fulfill, to bring something to its fullness, its completion, its finality in the teleological sense, to make it most fully itself, which does not mean unrestricted maximal production. Instead of imposing our demands for production onto the earth, we should attempt to listen to the soil first, to attend to its needs rather than assuming that we automatically know what's best for it without even knowing it first. As Barry goes on to say, a long view of an old agricultural landscape would show how fence rows and fields have conformed over time both to the natural topography and to human use, and how the location of dwellings, barns, and outbuildings reveals the established daily and seasonal patterns of work. Such farms were highly diversified and formally complex, and sometimes they were impressively sensitive both to the requirements of the place and to human need. Now, however, the quest for higher and higher production on farms leads almost inevitably to specialization, which in turn obliterates local proprieties of scale and proportion and obscures any sense of human connection. Driven by fashion, debt, and bad science, the desire for more overrides completely the idea of a home, or a home place, or a home economy, or a home community. The desire for quantity replaces the desire for wholeness or holiness or health. The sense of right proportion and scale cannot survive the loss of the sense of relationship of the parts to one another and to the whole. Under the new norm of the farm as factory, as producer of abundant quantity, the land is reduced to an instrument. Because human beings are connected in our being, in our bones, to the soil, because we were formed into Adam from the Adama, the Hebrew word for dirt, by God. In taking a reductive view of the earth, we take a reductive view of human society. Under the old norm of farm as form, the animating principle of human interactions with the earth was charity and dialogue oriented towards the fulfilling of the land. The aim of regenerative agriculture is to reinitiate this dialogue, to answer anew the vocation God gives man in creation by attending to the form of the land, by growing plants that are good for the soil of a particular place, by rotating crops and planting cover crops to restore the nutrients taken from the ground, by de-emphasizing use of heavy machinery that compacts dirt, just to name a few practices. If Barry and McGinley's arguments are right, then regenerative agriculture is central to the health of human society and therefore is closely bound up with the marketer's value of citizenship. It might be heartening then, if you did a quick Google search, if you were to see that within the last couple weeks, several multinational corporations have all made record-breaking investments in what they call regenerative agriculture. The marketing on the press releases is really, really good. And if you stay on a cursory level, you might actually believe that these agribusinesses are finally moving away from a quantity mindset. But the devil is in the details. PepsiCo Unilever, for instance, has recently announced its Step Up for Agriculture initiative, a first-of-its-kind collaboration to scale regenerative agriculture through locally tailored support systems, a first-of-its-kind collaboration to which includes enhancing implementation capabilities to support scalability and establishing measurement, reporting, and verification, MRV systems, to track sustainable progress against goals. In less gobbledygook terms, this initiative wants farmers to implement new types of technology to track the efficiency of their crops and where they came from so they can scale up their farming production, all with the aim to boost profitability in local economies. McDonald's, meanwhile, is partnering with the USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service and the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation on the Grassland Resilience and Conservation Initiative. Buried deep in its rancher FAQ, McDonald's reveals that what this investment means concretely is that it will fund projects that maximize soil function and develop and implement grazing management plans that optimize stocking rates and livestock movements and incorporate virtual fencing and other grazing infrastructure as appropriate. For both Pepsi, Unilever, and McDonald's, the term regenerative agriculture is simulated, exaggerated, and its true meaning is dissimulated, obscured. This deception belies the fact that neither are actually investing in authentic regenerative agriculture, just rebranding the same old ideology of quantity that made regenerative agriculture necessary in the first place. So why bother pretending at all? Why do these companies want to look like they're investing in regenerative agriculture? Simple. Striving to protect the ecological environment, to use the AMA's words, is a value that our society has, in general, determined is something it wants, something it sees as part of good citizenship. But to understand what it means to be a good citizen, we need to understand what it means to be human, and we lack that anthropology. We certainly, on a societal level, lack the shared understanding that God made us from the soil, and that our responsibility to fulfill the land is inscribed into our being since we were first created. Under the most charitable reading of their actions possible, the marketers of PepsiCo, Unilever, and McDonald's want to make their customers better by helping them recognize the value of their products. They know that society values, in the most general way possible, ecological justice, whatever that means. So these companies play up, simulate their support of regenerative agriculture so that way their customers can feel like the company's services are helping them to become better citizens. But the marketers at PepsiCo, Unilever, and McDonald's also know that the general public doesn't really understand what regenerative agriculture means. So in that absence of knowledge, it's up to the companies to determine the definition, which becomes whatever will make greater quantities of the product that people, by societal consensus, value. The marketing presumes that it knows better for us and the earth than we do, so it connects its product with sustainable citizenship of the earth and society, a value we all appreciate and want to possess ourselves. But the marketing dissimulates that the corporations are the ones to dictate what sustainable citizenship means in the absence of a shared definition of the human person and the cosmos as interconnected and possessing a form that is irreducible to quantity. And all this time, the customers fail to realize that the values they're trying to live up to have been given to them by the marketing department at a fast food company, whose guiding marketing principles have themselves been determined arbitrarily by societal consensus. All of this, of course, assumes the best case scenario, that we see friendship, even analogous friendship, as aimed at making the other more excellent, more fully themselves, even if our vision of what virtue could look like might be limited to the AMA's list of values, which we've already kind of had to bend just a little bit by de-emphasizing honesty and transparency so that we can, as marketers, be better sort of friends to our customers through ensuring that they see the value of our offerings, even if we have to exaggerate or downplay the truth to make that happen. But there are other ways to view friendship. Take, for example, what Aristotle refers to as friendships of pleasure, which in the words of theologian David Cloutier, revolve around simply enjoying one another's company or sharing fun leisure activities. You may have completely incompatible political or religious views, but have a great time shooting hoops together or hanging out at the bar. Cicero rejects these friendships in De Amicitia as insufficient for true friendship because they presume that the highest human good is pleasure rather than virtue or excellence of character. But Cloutier, following Aristotle and C.S. Lewis, asserts that though these are partial friendships, because they do not involve the full love of a friendship in which your friend is another self, they are still true friendships because they involve mutuality and well-wishing for one another. If this is the type of friendship the AMA is thinking of, a friendship built on an anthropology that human beings, including marketers, are meant for pleasure and fun, what would our marketing look like? Probably quite a bit like the winking, ironic meta-advertisements David Foster Wallace lambasts in his essay E Unibus Plurum. Cultural philosopher and Stanford MBA Ted Gioia noted recently that much of Wallace's criticism of television and advertising in the 1990s presages the habit-forming dopamine loops of social media, smartphone screens, and the marketing trends of the 2020s. And E Unibus Plurum is no exception. In an especially memorable section, Wallace discusses how contemporary advertising in 1993 had moved from the marketing of previous generations, which dealt with straightforward hard sell ads or quixotic associative ads that linked product offerings with romance, prettiness, and group inclusion, blatant buy this thing type commercials, which today's jaded viewer find old fashioned. Instead, marketing had moved to commercials that pitch parody and witty irony. Wallace draws on the example of a much-awarded Pepsi commercial. I was not expecting to complain this much about Pepsi this evening in my talk. The Thomistic Institute does not endorse the Coca-Cola Foundation, anyway. Even though we do serve Coke products at our events. Anyway, Wallace draws on the example of a much-awarded Pepsi commercial in which a Pepsi sound van pulls up to a packed, sweltering beach, and the impish young guy in the van activates a lavish PA system and opens a Pepsi and pours it into a cup next to the microphone. And the dense, glittered sound of much carbonation goes out over the beach's heat-wrinkled air, and heads turn vanward, as if pulled with strings at his gulp, and refreshed, spirenty sounds are broadcast. And the final shot reveals that the sound van is also a concession truck, and the whole beach's pretty population has collapsed into a clamoring mass around the truck, everybody hopping up and down and pleading to be served first as the camera's view retreats to overhead and the slogan is flatly intoned, Pepsi, the choice of a new generation. Wallace observes that the whole commercial is self-critical and winking and tongue-in-cheek to the viewer. We know, smart people that we are, that the behavior this commercial depicts completely contradicts its own slogan and any idea of free choice. The pretty young people on the beach are manipulable sheeple, but not us. We see how the Pepsi puppeteer pulls the strings, but we're too clever to dance for him. And the puppeteer, he respects us for that. In Wallace's words, the ad's uxorious in its flattery of only one person, the lone viewer, who even with an average brain can't help but discern the ironic contradiction between the choice slogan, sound, and the Pavlovian orgy, sight. The commercial invites us to see through the manipulation the beach's horde is rapidly buying, inviting complicity between its witty irony, veteran viewers' cynical, nobody's fuel appreciation of that irony. It invites us as viewers into an in-joke the capital A audience is the butt of. It congratulates us, in other words, on transcending the very crowd that defines us here. This ad boosted Pepsi's market share through 3 sales quarters. Wallace's broader point is contra-irony, the central value of popular culture, which flatters us, as Wallace says, about seeing through the pretentiousness and hypocrisy of ostensibly outdated values, and can stir up in us precisely the feeling of canny superiority this marketing has taught us to crave, to the extent that it can train viewers to view ridicule as both the mode of social intercourse and the ultimate art form. Television can reinforce its own queer ontology of appearance. The most frightening prospect for the well-conditioned viewer becomes leaving oneself open to others' ridicule by betraying passé expressions of value, emotion, or vulnerability. Other people become judges. The crime is naivete. The well-trained, lonely viewer becomes even more allergic to people. Now, Wallace is right about a lot here, but I want to recast this situation with maximal charity through the lens of what the AMA has suggested are the duties and values of the marketer. If marketers are meant to be honest and transparent, but also ensure that they're humanizing their advertising through empathy and treating their customers like friends, and if marketers have a vision of friendship that doesn't require them to try and treat their friends better than how they themselves would want to be treated, and if marketers see themselves as wanting, basically, a life of happiness and pleasure and fun with minimal pain, in which they can do basically whatever they want so long as it doesn't hurt other people, then the marketers are caught up in a catch-22 because of the power that marketing has over society. These marketers, in empathizing with their audience, would understand that they can't treat their customers the way they would want to be treated because of the fundamental imbalance of power in their relationship. Because marketers understand how marketing works, and an audience at large might not. The solution to this problem is to have these commercials invite the audience to empathize with the marketer by revealing explicitly how the process works. This is exactly what the Pepsi commercial is doing. It does flatter its audience, yes, but primarily, it aims to make the audience identify with the marketer. We take the side of the impish man in the van, not the beautiful hordes on the beach. Is it ironic? Yes. Does this irony risk pushing us away from relationships with other people by seeing them as Pepsi slurping cattle? Of course. But though it succeeds in making us allergic to the capital A audience, the commercial also aims to make us less allergic and more loyal to a different group of people, the marketers. In empathizing with their audience, the marketers have made their audience empathize with them, and there's a feeling of pleasure that comes to being part of this exclusive in-crowd. And what source of value was it that enabled you to feel this pleasure? Pepsi. What in crowd do you feel particular loyalty to now? Pepsi's. So the next time you're out in a restaurant or a grocery store and you're looking for a delicious soda on a hot day, and you want to feel that camaraderie, that esprit de corps, that exclusive in-crowd friendship again, what soda are you going to buy? Pepsi! This marketing isn't just flattery, it's empathy. You're identifying with your friend, the marketer. And your relationship puts you on an ostensibly more even, more equal, more fair footing with your friend, even as that relationship makes you do what everybody else in the capital A audience is doing, drinking Pepsi. Through dissimulation and simulation, predicated on treating their customers as they would want to be treated, or as friends, or empathetically, the marketers aim to benefit society as a whole by identifying legitimate human excellence with the value of their product. This feeds into the idea that greater and greater quantities of valuable things and services are automatically better for human life. Marketers also aim to take responsibility for their role in society by being transparent about the marketing techniques they're using through inviting individual viewers to empathize with the marketing mindset through irony, making the customer feel valued and pleased by inviting her to join the in-crowd of those beyond manipulation. The marketer, therefore, seems to achieve fairness and greater equity between marketer and customer. But in enacting all these practices, you know, these fairness, this equity, all of these principles which the AMA really values, marketers violate their first principle, do no harm. Because lurking behind all of this is a very basic fact. Peter Drucker's account of marketing as connecting customers with the value of a product holds weight, absolutely. But marketing isn't really marketing unless you're selling something. Marketing centers around transaction and exchange. You are aiming, even in the best case scenario, to convince people to give you their money or their time or some piece of their life in exchange for a product or a service that you're providing them. Lost in the absence of a sufficient anthropology is any idea that human beings are made for the truth, for reality. As the Thomistic philosopher Joseph Pieper argues in his essay, Abusive Language, Abusive Power, human words and language accomplish a twofold purpose. First, words convey reality. We speak in order to name and identify something that is real, to identify it for someone, which points us to the second aspect in question, the interpersonal character of human speech. All human communication seeks to know reality and to represent it accurately to another person. Deception fundamentally is a lack of communication, as it means specifically to withhold the other's share and portion of reality, to prevent his participation in reality. A lie is an affront to human dignity because it prevents dialogue, dialogos, a working together to discern the truth. Pieper asserts that this is the reason why Socrates was so opposed to the sophists, who were great flatterers, because flattery too is a lie, in which one no longer respects the other as a human person because she reduces the other to an instrument, a means to an end to get something that she wants. In other words, the decisive element of flattery is, in Pieper's words, having an ulterior motive. What I address to the other is designed to get something from him. He is no longer a fellow subject. Rather, he has become an object to be manipulated, possibly to be dominated, to be handled and controlled, his dignity ignored. So does marketing make us less human? Yes, presuming that what you mean by marketing is the textbook definition advanced by the American Marketing Association. For marketers to frame their relationship with their customers as a friendship, to say that marketing is a practice in empathy, or to claim that marketing is, as the AMA asserts, simply the activity, set of institutions and processes for creating, carrying, communicating, delivering, and exchanging offerings that have value for customers, clients, partners, and society at large, is to exaggerate the benefits marketing brings to the common good and to dissimulate marketing's ulterior motive, to get you to buy something. Attempting to remove this extremely obvious fact from our conception of marketing reduces it to flattery and sophistry. Though Aristotle contends that a friendship of utility, of mutual use between two persons, is to a certain degree possible, at least as an analogy to real friendship, Cicero rejects this entirely because, though even false friends might be useful, there is nothing false in true friendship.
nothing simulated. We know in our heart of hearts that when a person has an ulterior motive, is trying to get something out of us, even if that person is trying to butter us up, it hurts. It hurts to be manipulated, to be taken advantage of. Why? Lacking in anthropology, the AMA is unable to justify a rationale for why we should act honestly and transparently, why we shouldn't try to use marketing to manipulate others. The only way to account for why deception is wrong is if human beings are made for reality and for the truth, which places us in communion with the Logos. The good of man, says Pieper, consists in his perceiving as much as possible all things as they really are, and to live in accordance with the truth as the unveiling of reality. For all men are nurtured first and foremost by the truth. Everybody who learns to live as a true human being depends on their nourishment. Finally, Pieper claims that the natural habitat of truth is found in interpersonal communication. Truth lives in dialogue, in discussion, in conversation. It resides, therefore, in language, in the word. With a language being well-ordered when its words express reality with as little distortion and as little omission as possible. What would marketing look like informed by an anthropology that saw the good of man and of language in this light? Must marketing make us less human? Of course not. The last thing I want you to take away from this talk is that marketing is an intrinsic evil. It isn't. Even in its current state, marketing is quite well-meaning, which is part of what makes it so dangerous. It comes close to the truth, very close in places, but ultimately instrumentalizes language under the guise of honesty, equity, fairness, and inclusion so it can hide its instrumentalization of human beings, a move that Pieper claims is fundamentally totalitarian. That doesn't mean that you should stop being a marketing major if you are one, but it does mean that you need to be a smarter one, one who thinks seriously about the implicit definitions of what it means to be human and what kind of cosmos we're living in that underpin the work that you're doing. Likewise, an anthropology that recognizes that human beings are made in the image and likeness of the truth and called to be in relationship with the truth necessitates a transformation in the way we practice marketing. We need to be absolutely, extremely explicit with our customers that we are selling them something, that we are motivated significantly by the possibility of a transactional end. However, this need not be our only, nor even our primary end. If human beings are made for the truth, then communication that discloses reality, even the reality that I am trying to sell you something, contains within it the possibility of working together interpersonally to discern some greater, capital T, truth, and for us to flourish as human beings. Interpersonal relationship begins with dialogue. Even though I might not have convinced you, given that I've just been talking at you for the last 45 minutes, with a disclosing of the reality of who I am and an attention on my part to the reality of who you are, which provides marketers with the opportunity to reframe even transactional interactions around the good of the other. Imagine a world in which marketing began with attention to what the other person needs so she can become closer to the truth, become more spiritually healthy and holy, and become more fully a reflection of the Logos. That doesn't mean we should use manipulative marketing techniques to try and get people to convert. Rather, the job of the marketer should take on a more... Watch The Chosen, season 4 on Netflix. I'm going to get fired from the TI. All right. Rather, the job of the marketer should be to take on a more pedagogical, more dialogic, more Socratic light, as we stir up in people's hearts the desire for the truth by revealing how pursuing it will concretely and positively improve our customers' lives. What I'm proposing is a vision of marketing which begins with a statement like, okay, I want to be straightforward with the fact that I'm trying to sell you a product or a service, but I also want to be clear that the reason that I'm doing this is not because I'm just trying to take your money from you, but because based on what I know about you, I think that this would really improve your life and make you a better person in this or that concrete way, and might even help lead you to heaven. And here are the reasons why I think that, and you're more than welcome to disagree with them, but if you do, I'd like to know why. That might be a little idealistic, it might be a little overstated. Fair enough. But what I'm trying to get at is the necessity of reframing the work of the marketer from false friend to true servant, someone who is legitimately trying to serve the most human need of the other, the need for reality. As Andreas Widmer has recently argued in his book, The Art of Principled Entrepreneurship, which I can't recommend enough,
which grapples with similar problems in the world of startups. Human beings are not made for companies, for products. Companies and products are made for people. Their primary tasks are to provide us with the legitimately human work of creating something new, to give us the opportunity to serve others, and to reward everyone involved, not just through financial remuneration, but with the opportunity to grow in legitimate human excellence and virtue rooted not in arbitrarily decided values, but in concrete ways of becoming more like the person of the truth, the Logos himself, Jesus Christ. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.